I mean, he's been putting in work for so long.
Putting a lot of work.
What's going on, guys? Welcome to a special PAX Online edition of Putting in Work, the interview podcast as part of the 8-Bit Collective. We are powered by Audio Technica, and I'm your host, John O'Peck, bringing you the first ever video version of the show for this panel. And we have to thank everybody joining us on Twitch. I'll be in there interacting with anyone who might have questions as we go. But today we are deep diving into how performance can bring video game icons to life. And we're looking at both voice acting and motion capture. So we're joined by two of the very best in the business. Between them, I think they've been in just about every video game franchise you could have think of or ever heard of. And first up, we have a Jedi, a Disney princess, a Metroid fighting bounty hunter, the leader of the Deadlock gang, and of course the commander of the Normandy. It's Jennifer Hale. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
I might edit in some thunderous applause since there's no live audience.
Can I have that as my morning wake up?
Yeah.
Right?
And then alongside Jennifer, we have your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. He is the Prince of Persia, the savior of Sunset City, and a crucial member of the Persona 4 investigation team, Yuri Lowenthal. How you doing, Yuri?
Thank you. I'm doing well. Thank you. I mean, as well as any of us can in this unprecedented and weird moment in life.
Yeah. I have to ask, how did I do introducing you? Because you've each done about 1,000 different roles throughout your careers.
That was good. So. Yeah. That was good. I should have you do my introductions. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why I always leave it up to, you know, the host to do that because
we work under NDA all the time or code name, and then it's a couple of years before things come out and people will sometimes hand me stuff and I'll be like, oh, I'm in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And because NDAs are so strict, I'm afraid to talk about things sometimes, even after it's come out. I'm like, I'm not sure. I have to consult the company before I, yeah.
I yep. so get that. I kept getting texts from Erin Fitzgerald. She was at BlizzCon, and I on the Friday of BlizzCon, when the year they announced Ash, and I was scheduled to appear on the Saturday, but nobody knew that. And she kept texting going, I'm hearing this trailer. They played it today. It's you. And I was like, and I finally just had to email my agents. I'm like, can I please say yes or no? And they're like, go ahead. I was like, okay, it's me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. When they dropped that first Spider-Man trailer, and clearly it was me. And clearly I was getting, you know, texts and emails, stuff saying congratulations on that. And it took 8 months from the time they dropped the trailer to the time that they wanted to announce who it was. So I had to spend like 8 months pretending that I didn't know what anybody was talking about.
I so get this. I was in New York when they did a big event for the Iron Man VR game, and they're playing clips, and I'm in New York, and they had Josh and Chantal there, and I was like, can I say it? And they're like, nope. And they finally just announced like a month ago that I'm Pepper Potts in the new Iron Man VR. I was like, oh my God.
Congratulations, by the way. I didn't even know that. That's amazing.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Mocap, man. Doing that mocap was, you know, it's the best.
We'll get into all
that good details very, very soon.
We've totally hijacked you, John.
No, it's good. We want the banter. So that's what we're here for.
we can banter. Just ask any voice director.
So yeah, I guess
that's what this is going to devolve into, I promise you.
They're more like very strict elementary school teachers. They don't want to shut up and focus.
I will try and direct you, but I might not be quite as good as an audio engineer. So I think like all the superheroes that you've both portrayed and like you just mentioned with Pepper Potts, it's probably good to start off with some origin stories. So Jennifer, what is the thing about voice acting that hooked you back at the start of your career in the arts? Because I'm sure, you know, as a young actress in whatever decade that was, there was many avenues to go down, and you probably didn't think I'm going to be known for video games, right?
No, I was hooked by the fact that somebody paid me $30 to do a commercial. I was like, what? I think it was 35, to be fair. It was 30 or 35. I'd gone to a fine arts high school, and my thing was rock and roll. I'd been singing in clubs for a short time at that point, and I started singing in clubs when I was 15. It was illegal. But, you know, I acted like an adult. I sort of went to a certain age and stopped there. I know I regressed. Anyway, just the fact that I got paid to come in and do a voice acting spot. And then these beautiful humans at the studio where I did it were kind enough to mentor me, because I pestered them a lot. And then I put on a little suit and I went door to door, and I was still in my teens, like to ad agencies with my little hair in a bun, cold calling ad agencies to get work. And
adorable. And,
I just, I saw it as a way forward. I have a business degree, and I remember sitting in university and just going, I mean, it was statistics, and I loved statistics, or maybe it was accounting, which I actually weirdly enough really liked too. And I remember thinking, I can't do a traditionally structured job. I'll go crazy. So this was perfect.
Yeah. And was there a point where voice acting, like the voice part of that, became the focus for you that you remember?
It was the first paid, well, the first paid gig I got was an on-camera commercial, but the voice one really captured my heart, because I think it was I could feel the infinite possibility of it, and I could feel that I could build it into something. And I'd always had this kind of relationship with my voice. I didn't even know voice acting existed. But I sort of knew there was something inside. I was an extremely shy kid. I moved a lot, and one of the towns I lived in was, the kids were pretty vicious, and I was bullied a lot, and I was isolated, quite isolated. So I never really spoke up in class, but one day at a career, you know, survey of what possible careers there are, they were talking about advertising, and they asked about a slogan for a certain coffee thing, an old coffee commercial. And out of my very shy, very closed mouth flew this thing going, they said, what's the slogan? Does anyone remember the slogan? And I went, just involuntarily, it's mountain grown. And everyone fell out laughing, and I turned bright red. I was like, let the earth swallow me now. So voice acting, where you're in a booth and you're isolated, was a phenomenal thing that I just was lucky enough to fall into.
Yeah. Very cool. I'm drinking my coffee right now and thinking, yeah, mountain grown. That does sound good. Yuri, same question to you. Like, was there a point where the voice came out as the way forward for you?
Yeah, you know, I think for everyone, it's a slightly different path, but we all get to that same point. I had come out to Los Angeles to do TV and film, and I, you know, come from theater in New York, and I was just looking for work. And we were both, my wife and I, who were, you know, we came out to do the same thing. And we were trying to find things besides waiting tables and, you know, being secretaries to make money. Like what could we do as actors? And Tara said, what about voice acting? And I'm embarrassed to say that I hadn't thought of that, because I was the one in the family who grew up, you know, watching cartoons and playing video games. Like, that should have been the first thing that I thought of, but it seemed somehow like this job that wasn't available to any, you know, mortal beings. So I hadn't even considered it. And so we both took a basic class, and we made a demo, and we started, you know, just beating the pavement, you know, getting that out and trying to, you know, auditioning and so on. And one little gig led to another little gig. I think my first paid gig doing that was a CD-ROM. Hey kids, remember CD-ROMs? No, you're too young. You remember? Okay. So it was a CD-ROM that came with, like, if you bought a 2-liter bottle of 7-Up or something like that, it came with the CD-ROM. That's the game you could play. And I think that was my first one of those things. And then I also sort of simultaneously had been, the guy I had taken the class with got a job directing anime dubs. And he started auditioning students of his. And I got into that world as well. And so it all came together very quickly. And, you know, much like Jennifer just said, the infinite possibilities, the empowerment, I think, is what did it for me. As actors, you know, we have very little power as far as, you know, they cast you for this right here and what you look like, and they can't see outside that. But all of a sudden, so many more things became available. So many more different roles and so many more different stories became available, because I can sound different than I sound different than I look right now. You know, I still sound, you know, like I'm, you know, in my teens. And I'll hold on to that as long as I can.
You sound like Spider-Man.
Right. It's crazy, right? although I guess with Spider-Verse now, you can start casting all sorts of ages of Peter Parker.
Yeah.
But that was sort of, but that's where it sort of took off for me. And while I'm still different parts of me are fulfilled by different types of acting and acting in different arenas, from theater to on camera and so on. This has been the lifesaver. This has been the mortgage payer. This has been, you know, the lifeblood, and it's so great.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you mentioned growing up watching cartoons and playing games. It's possible that Jennifer was in some of those because you were doing a lot of animation in the early 90s, right? I mean, you would have been a bit older. I'm not saying that like you were a child when Jennifer was acting.
So you're saying I'm Yuri's mom.
But I guess
I'm older than I look.
I guess my point is that voice acting was probably less common in video games when you were starting out, Jennifer. It was more like the TV and film. When did you realize that voice acting was becoming this more reliable source of work in video games specifically?
Well, I mean, like Yuri, I started my voice acting stuff in a small town. Well, yeah, what we consider a small market. And actually for anybody starting out, that's a really great hack because you can get a huge volume of experience because the pool of talent available to them is smaller. So you can hit more things. You can expand into side markets that are near you, and really get a lot of experience. So that was my first step. And then I moved to LA like you, Yuri, to get the film and TV work. And I said, I'll just make a tape to make some money because I know how to do that.
Right.
And now I've lost track of your question, Jono.
When video games became that reliable source.
That actually, I had a reason for going down that road. And I remember, I've been doing this a long time, you know, and one of the things that I learned early on, which was a lifesaver to figure out because I didn't take it personally, is that you're going to be in fashion and you're going to be out of fashion. It has nothing to do with you and your talent. You're just, it's your turn and then it's not your turn. Then it's your turn, then it's not your turn. So for me, just as a business decision, if I had multiple avenues that I could pursue to bring an income, you know, animation, commercials, I honestly went and made a voice tape hoping to make some money doing some commercials because I wasn't even allowed to watch cartoons as a kid. And I didn't play video games. I was in a rock and roll band working 30 hours a week and going to university all at the same time. So I had no time. So I started, my first break in LA was, my first audition was the series Where on Earth is Carmen Sandiego. And that was my first game as well, because they made the game to go with it. Right. Mm-hmm. And it was at a time when they'd buy a 64 episode, you know, series by. And so
The good old days.
I know. I kept thinking I was going to get fired every week because I had no idea what I was doing, but I dove into class like you.
I still feel that way.
Oh my, it's amen, right? I'm like, okay.
Right? So many years later.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay. I don't care.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I got fired again.
I don't know what.
Yeah. You're not a professional until you've been fired. Yeah.
And I'm like, there'll be another one. So I recognized that as much as I was in fashion and say animation, it was going to be they're going to need a break. And, you know, I'd bump to a different seat on the animation train and then commercials took off and then games. So when games came along, the workload on games was decidedly different to the workload in animation because it's the same. The booking is essentially the same. Generally, it's a 4-hour, for voice acting as opposed to mocap, it's a 4-hour session. And in that 4-hour session in animation, you know, Yuri and I are sharing the load with our other castmates and we're all taking turns and doing the dog and pony dance there over that time. And there's a few breaks and there's chit chat and this and that. And in a game session, and also you get the script ahead of time and you're recording generally in sequence of the storyline. In games, it's a 4-hour one person show and you get a couple of pee breaks and that's it. And you generally, most of the time, don't get the script ahead of time and it's out of sequence. And it's a very mentally intense process. And I remember in the beginning, I just said, sure, because I was all about squirreling away the money. I wanted to buy a house and I just wanted to work. And I never knew when I was going to be out of fashion. So I just busted it as long as I was in fashion, you know, make hay while the sun shines. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of my approach. And weirdly enough, that just led me into more and more games and into falling in love with that format. And also getting to ride a really interesting evolutionary curve as visuals changed so the acting could change. And then the whole format opened up to the stories and the universes just got cooler and bigger and more diverse. And
that's really cool. I'm interested in that evolution because it feels like you've been there for the whole thing. You know, you were in Baldur's Gate and then, you know, Metal Gear Solid as Naomi. It's like, that, at least for me as a young 10-year-old gamer, it was like, this is where I realized that games could do similar things to what film and movies could do. The narrative experiences that you could get the performance out of that rivaled those mediums. So I wouldn't have expressed it that well as a 10-year-old, but that's how I look back at it now.
If you had, I'd have chased you down as a genius.
But was there a point that you realized that games had that potential suddenly?
It's funny, when I'm doing things, I'm very much in the moment. I'm mm-hmm. very much Dory. I'm like, hello, oh, hi, who are you? You know, like, right. I think you have to be, because that's our job, is to bring the moment to life in the moment. And I never have an eye on, is this going to be a big game or not?
Yeah, right.
Even if it's a big franchise, because sometimes it is, sometimes it's just not. But I always play everything as if it has the potential to change the world for the better. Because why not? Why not?
Stories can do that.
Yes.
Can do that, I believe. Yeah.
And this is a magic medium, because it's not simply a narrative medium. It's a medium of co-creation. Like, these players are, when they're choosing paths and choosing, you know, in the truly, because it was interactive. I remember my first game, I don't know about you, Yuri, but I was presented with just a list of flags, and I'm like, I just say, who am I talking to? All those actors, right. Who am I talking to? What do I want? And they're like, just say the name of the flag. And I'm like, okay. Right. And after asking twice, I was like, just say the name of the flag, Jen. It's what you're being paid for. And it's like, okay. Right. But there's so much potential for power in this co-creation that we do together, because the players choose, the players pick, and they spend so much more time with us than they do with a film or even a book. Like, they spend so much time with us.
Yeah, for sure. And Yuri, I think, like, for you, by the time you started picking up roles in, like, some popular games like Prince of Persia, that shift into the cinematic storytelling in games had become a lot more common. Was there a game that you remember playing or working on that made you realize, you know, this is going to be a career where I can sink my teeth into it and actually get some, you know, help bring some memorable characters to life, not just maybe, you know, what people kind of grew up thinking video games had the potential to do with storytelling?
I mean, you talk about The Prince of Persia. That was definitely one. I mean, I think that was the first one that I worked on where I had, you know, where I was a lead character in it. And the writing was, it was one of those perfect storm games where the writing was great and the gameplay was great. You know, and the story was great. And the puzzles were, like, everything sort of came together on that game. Sure. And I still consider myself very lucky. It's still, to this day, you know, many years later, it's still one of my favorite experiences and one of my favorite roles. And the way people reacted, like, you know, Jen said, you never know. You know, when I was protector of Sunset City, I thought that film or that game was going to be the biggest game that year, if not, you know. And for whatever reason, you know, it catches fire or it doesn't. And that had nothing to do, I think, with the project or the quality of the project or the storytelling or anything, but you just never know. So I've gotten, you know, humbled so many times that I thought something was going to be big or something was going to be great or something was really going to work. Much like Jensen, you just got to sort of concentrate on that moment. You've got to work with the people. It is a group thing. There's, you know, the writing that goes into it. There are the animators that are working with your performance. There's the direction from the voice direction, the animation direction, you know, all on down the line to that part of the storytelling that oft gets forgotten that Jen just mentioned, the player, you know, then the player writes the end of that story. Mm-hmm. So it's in no way something that is, you know, whether you're the lead of the game or not, it's never your game. It's never your game. Mm-hmm. It's a whole team's game. And I love, you know, coming from theater, so I love being part of an ensemble. I love being part of a group thing. And this is always that, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
It's funny, what you just said reminded me of a feeling I always have about it, which is I feel like I'm just the ink in the tip of the pen.
Right.
You know, I'm the part you see, but there's an entire, there's an entire huge machinery that makes that all possible.
Yeah. That's a good way to look at it. But that ink is very, very important.
Yeah, if it doesn't flow, you know, you can't run.
Yeah,
exactly.
It doesn't land.
I mean, I've mentioned already, like, you've been in some huge franchises over the years, Baldur's Gate, Metal Gear Solid, quite early in that career. But I think a lot of people would associate you with Commander Shepard, even if it's only one of you know, 200 roles or whatever it is in games. So I'm curious how significant the Mass Effect trilogy is in your career. as a performer, you know, being able to come back after the first game and know that this is something that people are going to be, you know, it's going to be popular because there's this established IP now and there's going to be a bit more attention on it and you're going to be known for it to some level. So does that at least make you approach it with any other perspective?
I never think of that. It pulls me out of what my job is. I can't. For me, the way this machine works, if I think of that, my attention is on something that doesn't serve the writing and the piece, because then it becomes about me and it becomes about popularity and it becomes about money and it becomes about all those things. And you know, and I love money. Money to me, I design in a different way. It flows in a different way. Meaning from intention and from sort of a big picture perspective. I can't because, you know, my thinking is the most, my attention is one of the most powerful tools I have as a human. And where it goes is where I go, where my future goes, where my feeling goes, where my vibe goes, where everything goes. And when I show up to work, if my attention is on what I'm going, those things are about what I can get.
Sure.
And if I keep my attention there, I am diminished for what I can bring. And instead I keep my attention on, who am I here? You know, my job, who am I? What do I want? Who am I talking to? I'm so busy with the human connection, just all the acting work that I have to do to not be acting. Like the, you know, who am I? What's the humanity of this character? What do we have in common? What parts of me do I put on the shelf? What do I pull out? Oh God, okay, I have to access this piece of me. Am I serving the writer? Am I serving the writer? Am I serving the writer? Because writers make the world go round. You know, I have to say this, it just occurred to me. I got to serve Yuri and Tara as writers and creators in this incredible project called Shelf Life that I had the best time
Look it up, it's all on YouTube, guys. 50 episodes, yeah.
Oh my God, it's so good. I got to do one. So much fun. It was just a dream. I got to play this character called Killerina, which was, and these guys, what they made was magic. And just to show up and serve creators like that, that's what we do, right? And if we don't do it 100%, it's like auditions. My philosophy is if you go into an audition with an eye on how you're doing, you're not 100% there. You have to let go of it. And it's your one chance to do that piece for that few minutes at 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes or however long it is. You might get another one and there's a check attached, but this is it. This is your chance to serve the writer. Go, you know?
Yeah. And I wish that I could say it's always easy for me to divorce myself from that. And sometimes I think about it or I never think about it. But I have found that when it's an iconic character that there's already a lot of baggage attached to it.
Yeah.
Like say a Spider-Man or like any, you know, anything from, you know, the comics that I was reading, you know, growing up and I can't, you know, when I'm doing it, I still, you know, I can't believe that it's happening. And B, like I spent 3 years working on Spider-Man confident that I was going to ruin Spider-Man for a whole new generation of game players. Like it's such a huge, such a heavy mantle to wear, to carry. I was at the same time thrilled and at the same time terrified. In some ways I like characters that nobody's heard of before that I could just sort of get into and there's nothing attached. But on the other hand, because I'm a huge nerd, every time I get to play one of those characters that, you know, that I knew growing up, it's just like I can, you know, check that one. Nice, you know. I try to. Jen's definitely right on that. It's a lot easier to work when you're not thinking outside, you know, looking in. But sometimes it's hard.
Well, I think for me it's a survival tool because it falls into the category of things I can control versus things I can't. Yeah. And the way my brain works, if I'm involved, I should be doing something to the best of my ability and I should know everything about it. Right. And if I don't have any control over it, I'll make myself bananas, not in a good way, like really ill, crazy, worrying about stuff I can't control. And that's where that came from for me. It was not something I was born with. I had to really work for it. Like, no, like dog training, like stop.
Right. Yeah.
No, you know, snap, whatever it takes. I had to train myself into this thinking. But I did it for purely for sanity reasons. Like I'll go crazy trying to worry about that stuff. I can't control that.
Yeah.
So with Spider-Man Yuri specifically, like that performance seems like one that people will associate with you for a long time. So I can imagine as a human being, it would be hard to disassociate from that. Like you guys have just mentioned. So
yeah, I hope they do. I'm extremely proud of it. It's one of the greatest things I've ever
done. You should be.
Yeah.
It's a great performance in a great game. But so to pick up a script like that and work with the director and the dialogue engineer to bring a character to life that's got so much, you know, behind it, so much reputation and iconography. How do you approach that to do it justice?
Well, again, I'll go back to that whole team aspect of it. Whenever I felt nervous about that sort of thing, I had to go back and remember that everybody who was working on that game was a huge Spider-Man fan, and they all wanted to succeed. And they, when I was worried about failing, I would remember that they weren't going to let me.
Yeah.
You know, that they were, if something wasn't working, we would figure it out. If it wasn't good enough, we'd make it better. Everybody cared so much on that. And also, like Jen said, you know, when the writing is good, our job becomes extremely easy. Yeah. So luckily the writing was fantastic on there. It was, a lot of people believed in it, so we were allowed a little more leeway than sometimes, you know, on a game that is, you know, they're really worried about the budget and they're really worried about getting on time, all that stuff. I think once we had done a certain amount of work on the game, enough people were like, oh, we should, you know what, this is going to be good. We think we're going to give you guys maybe a little more time or a little more money. I mean, I'm not privy to those discussions, but that's how I felt it sort of went. Yeah. And so we were allowed to take the time with it. But yeah, it's trusting the other people around you. It's a trust fall. You know, I felt that if something was not working, that they would tell me and that we would fix it. And you have to remember that every now and then, you know, when I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to ruin everything. You're like, you know what? You're giving yourself too much credit. It's not just you.
Yeah.
They've got good. You. So yeah.
That's really interesting. And I think, like Jen, I'm curious to you, like working with BioWare on a game like Mass Effect, as well as previous to that, the team process to bring a character to life that has since become iconic in gaming culture, like Commander Shepard. For you, what's it like? Like, we're here talking about bringing, making game characters iconic. So what is it, do you think, about what you bring to that performance that has helped it do so well, aside from obviously the great writing?
I mean, I don't know how much credit I can take. I'll take the credit that belongs to me, which is I threw down with everything I had. And a dear friend of mine told me the concept years ago of divine spark, which is when you're in touch with the highest and best parts of yourself. And you do a job like, for instance, our job, where it gets recorded and sent out to people. If you connect to that highest and best part of yourself, it will land on whatever transmission material exists and it will get transmitted out and it will spark people on the other side if there's whatever's highest and best in them. Mm. Not in a literal way, not in a preachy way, but just in like this little fairy dust kind of way. And I held that very close, and I was working with a group of people. I never said it out loud, but it doesn't need to be said. But was working with a group of people who were absolutely committed to making a beautiful game and to making an incredible and profound experience. And it was a collective joy. It was really remarkable. We just hit a groove, and there was no ego. That was the thing. It wasn't, there's a thing, you know, I'm sure you've bumped into this. You know, you want to be something, and then you hit it and you kind of become something. And then you're like, uh-oh, I'm something. I better be that something so I can stay that something.
Right.
You know, and I've found great salvation in being nothing. If I am no thing, then I can be everything. I can be anything, right? I can just let it go. You know, this thing is probably the releasing of the ego, which, good Lord, that's a life's work, but at least turning it way down. And I think that team collectively, really, I didn't ever send, there was no ego anywhere in that zone. It was just all about channeling the muse and making something awesome.
That's great. And with like so many lines of dialogue and optional dialogue, and I'm assuming it's probably quite a disjointed recording process where it might be a real challenge to zoom out from the page of the script and think about the context of how you're reading that line. So I think that you deserve, both of you with the games you've worked on, a lot of credit for making the character authentic and come to life with that in mind, like where am I, what's this scene, like who am I talking to, you know, they're not in there acting with you. So to bring that to the booth, how do you kind of make that all work?
Well, thank you for go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Go
I was gonna say thank you for giving us some of that credit, but the having a good voice director on who has the whole picture, you know, in her head is a huge boon. And because we are often not given parts of the script or told other parts of the story, and having a director who can be there to immediately give you the information that you need in a very short period of time. One director worked on both Spider-Man and Metal Gear, Chris Zimmerman, and she's you know, been doing this long enough, and with both has a relationship with both of us that, you know, her direction is very concise and very you know, it's very, very straight forward. And you know, if you didn't already, you know the relationship, you would think that we were the bad kids or something like that. But she, you know, having a good director who can impart that that type of information to allow you to know where you are in any given scene with any given person, what the relationships are in the context, is huge.
That was it. My two words were voice director.
That's a good
unsung hero. Like that's a panel I would love to sit through, is the voice directors talking about things from their perspective, because they are the invisible hand that makes the difference.
I'll try and line them up for next year.
Well, we can definitely hook you up with Chris.
Oh, great! That would be awesome. Yeah. So I think that's a good time to maybe seg into talking about motion capture, because that is an instance where maybe you are able to perform with context and another person in front of you. I want to know what it was like for you guys the first time you did that. I don't know how long ago that was, because it's a process that's been evolving. But I know that you did motion capture for Halo 4, Jennifer, is that right?
A few things.
So the first time you did that, was it like going back to theater, or did it feel like a brand new thing because you've got, you know, little cameras all over your face, or, you know, ping pong balls, wetsuit, whatever you want to describe it as?
I'll speak briefly and then I'm going to hand it off to Yuri, because he's done a lot as well. I can't even remember what the first mocap was I did. I was sitting here going, was it that one? And you were talking about, Jonah, you said working with actors face to face, and I thought, or a tennis ball.
Right
when it was doing God of War, like, you know, I had to look at Kratos's face, and he's 8 feet tall. So acting with an actor, but I'm talking to a tennis ball.
Talk to the tennis ball.
It's, Yuri, you can say your perspective on this, but my experience is, it's the body's doing theater while the voice is doing film, and then the rest of you is doing pretend, because you're jumping off giant gray boxes and hanging off scaffolding to be the ladder of an airplane, or talking into a gray box because it's the salvation of the world, you know.
It's definitely that. It's a very full circle thing for me. I did, I think my first mocap job, I don't know exactly how long ago, it had to be at least 10 years ago, I guess, but it was a racing game that they ended up scrapping all of the mocap for it at the last minute. They're like, we don't need any of that. But it was a great training ground for me. But it does feel very full circle. I started in theater and, you know, went into a booth where I don't have the use of my body or my face to convey anything. And now we're back to, it's sort of unifying everything in one. And I love it. And I think it's why so much of what we do is solo in a booth and creating that performance based on our imagination has to be huge. And with motion capture and performance capture, we've been able to get that type of nuanced performance that you get when you have two actors face to face, or as close as the camera will allow you to be face to face. To another actor, sometimes it's awkward. Yeah, exactly. We've clanked headgear. We've almost, you know, wrecked expensive cameras so many times. But having that's why I think the performances, to take Spider-Man, the cinematic performances, I think clicked, because I was face to face with Bill Salyers, and he is a much better actor than me. And his performance made my performance better. And if I had not been acting with him, you know, on the stage, if we had not been performing at the same time with our bodies and our faces and our voices and everything, even with all the artifice of having to wear that suit and having dots on our face and a camera, those performances, probably if we had recorded them separately, would have been fine. They would have been great, and people still would have said, oh, it's a great scene. But that we were in the same room made them better. And that's why I think the cinematics and the in, you know, in that storytelling and in Spider-Man work so well is because they got the actors together in the room. And it's like putting on a play again, but it's sort of like shooting a movie because yeah, it's a weird synthesis of all those things. Yeah. And then sometimes, you know, very often on Spider-Man, it was, if Spider-Man was supposed to do something really cool and Spider-Man-y, it was me standing over the shoulder mirroring a stunt guy, either Ross or Seth, you know, I attribute half of my performance in Spider-Man to, because if it was, you know, Peter Parker doing something nerdy or awkward, that was very likely me. But if it was Spider-Man doing something cool, that was Ross or Seth probably, because I'm, you know, too old to be risking my life flipping around like a crazy person. So it was an interesting way of performing. Sometimes it was just my voice over the shoulder of a guy whose movements they were going to take. And it was like a dance. It was like this really cool dance with our stunt performance.
That's great. I've heard you talk about that a little, and it sounds like you had a lot of fun working with them. Do you think motion capture is recognized enough as part of that equation to bring performances to life?
Yes and no. I think still not enough is understood about that. You know, I love people who champion that, like Andy Serkis, you know, was out there to let people know that. But I think when you champion that end too much, you forget about the people who get overlooked or the animators who then take your performance and turn it into what it is you'll eventually see. So even at that level, there's so many more things that are happening that people aren't aware of. Mm-hmm. So yes, I think it's becoming a little more recognized, but I think it's still very misunderstood. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who still don't, because they used a separate actor in Spider-Man, because I'm older than the 23 they were looking for, there is an actor that they modeled the face off of. And so everybody assumes that he also did all the performance while I just did the voice, which is not the case. So, you know, it's very intricate and subtle.
It kind of reminds me of like Star Wars. You've got James Earl Jones, as everyone knows, as Darth Vader, but who was the performer? It was some
David
like
Prowse.
Yeah, it David was some Prowse, 6 foot seven, 6 foot eight guy that
bodybuilder. You
know, a lot of people don't know he's not the household name of James Earl Jones, but he was the visual performer. I'm curious, what is more challenging for you guys? Because there's an authenticity of a scene when you're out there acting with someone. But when you're in a booth, you have to convey that without being able to do it. But then you're able to give the more clear and nuanced performance that you might not be able to do when you're running around and focusing on stepping in the right place and where's the camera and where's the other person out there with me. So yeah, I'm curious of a voice acting where it's a bit more on your vocal or the physicality of mocap, which one of those is the greater challenge?
I don't distinguish a lot between the two. I mean, there are distinctions that are necessary, and in voice acting in the booth, it's don't move out of the box, you know? And I move a lot outside the box, but don't wear anything noisy and don't move this. Everything else moves. And I didn't realize this till somebody pointed it out. Well, no, I did, but I didn't spend a lot of mental time on it. I will take a line off the page, sort of instant memorize it, pick it up and say it to my pretend friend in the room with me, who I try to place here or here so I don't go off mic. And accidentally, sometimes my imagination puts him over there and I get in trouble because I turn my head. So that's the one restriction, is I don't move this, but everything else is happening the same. And then with mocap, everything else moves. It just has to move according to a prescribed formula. And I've got to get it in my body so that I can actually relax and be in the moment. One of the differences, though, that I think is untapped magic for voice acting is our interaction in games, is our interaction with each other. There is that extra magic Yuri was talking about, in addition to somebody raising the game, raising the level for us, you know, depending on what's happening in the moment. There's just that unnameable magic that happens with another human being when you're actually there with them and talking to them and present with them. And that to me is the gold. Like even now, even in our current, you know, COVID structure, you can do a group record, you know, virtually. Like it's possible. And that's the magic. I hope that we tap into that more, because that raises the level, and it raises the level of connection, and it gives them more of that secret sauce that helps games be more popular. Mm. Yeah.
Yuri, anything to add?
No, I think she nailed it. Yeah.
All right. I don't know where this fits in, but I just want to mention how much I love the fact that you recorded Spider-Man lines in case you were the character was swinging through the air. And that's a great story.
That was something that they hadn't started out doing at the very beginning, but then realized that they didn't know certain lines would trigger. They were like, well, this line is going to be triggered. You know, he might be just sort of sitting there, or he might be swinging, you know, through the city. And usually, you know, in games, I mean, that's not a new concept to games for sure. Yeah. But in the past, what they'll say is, give us a read that might work sort of with both. Right. And you have to sort of go down the middle and it could sort of work with both. And this time they were like, you know what? We want to try something. We want to have sort of an at rest, a sort of a calmer read, and then a read that feels more like it's in action. Mm-hmm. And we'll program it just so that, you know, we'll code it so that one or the other will trigger depending on what you're doing. And we weren't sure if it was going to work. And it was, and when people noticed, you know, whether it was going to work or people would even sort of notice, but people noticed immediately. And I feel bad for games that are coming out after that, because now everybody's like, oh shit, now, you know, and we all have to do that to get that
in the bar.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Which I'm not sad about. Also, you know, I got called in for more sessions because I had to record two versions of so much of the script that it was, you know, I get paid by the session. So it actually worked out. It was people's like, oh, that must have been so much harder for you. I'm like, it was more work, but it was more work, you know? So
fantastic. Yeah.
It was great though. I adopted I don't know if they've ever posted any sort of video of me recording the two different versions, but one is me like right in front of the mic. And then one is me in front of the mic doing this, you know, like, just to sort of get the feel that, you know, that there's some movement in it. You know, your lungs get compressed differently when you're, and at first we had to dial it in, because when I was first trying to find the two different things, they were like, I remember he's Spider-Man. It's not so hard. Like this is, you're sitting up, you sound kind of constipated, you know, it's easy for him. He's in motion,
right?
Yes, it would. he's in motion, but you know, he's Spider-Man, swinging through the city is what he does. So we had to find that sort of just delicate balance of effort without seeming like it was hard for him. One? Yeah. We had a head mic and a mic in front. Yeah. Because then also you're getting it, you can move a little more because the mic's not right in front of you. And when you go out, cause it's stuck to your forehead basically.
Yes.
And so that's the way they do it when you're in the mocap suit, and they've taken to adding that mic in the booth when you're recording VO so that they have that version as well as the, you know, the nice mic.
That's why I keep this in my booth now. This is
that's part of my baseball cap in the booth is de rigueur now. Yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah. The magic, how the magic happens.
Right. Yeah. Sorry if you've seen how the sausage is made, you can't unsee it or unhear it.
Don't watch the making of the sausage show if you don't want to know how it's made.
Right. That's true. You're tuning in.
That's it. It's a panel for the sausage.
Who chose this?
Yeah, it's the sausage show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Sorry. The mostly sausage show between me and John.
It's a great detail, and it's something like if you're playing a game like Red Dead and they're riding horses and they're 15 meters apart, you do notice like they're yelling across to each other, and it does bring that kind of sense of realism that I think.
And the
really
coconuts
important.
Really make it live.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think from the past few things we've been talking about, we can agree that video game developers are wizards and magicians, and anyone that works in games should be praised for skills that are hard to comprehend.
Right, pretty much.
And the hours, the sheer volume of work they do, the load that they carry. Yeah.
I'm interested now, this show is called Putting in Work, and I want to know what's the hardest part of what you do, or the hardest part of your journey to get to where you are at the moment.
To keep putting in work. Because the work, you know, we talk in such glowing terms about, you know, doing the work that we do, because once you've, you know, you've got that job, that's the fun part. But getting each of those jobs, you know, we still audition all the time and don't get most of the jobs we audition for. So it's like, if you had to go out for, you know, a job interview, if you had to go out for like 5 or 6 job interviews a day, and you got maybe, you know, 1 in 100, You know, dealing with that type of rejection over time, you gotta find a way to love even that part of it, or at least not be destroyed when you don't get something. Like, it's, you can't take it personally, but that's the work, you know.
I think yeah, I agree 100% with that. That's beautiful. You're right. It's not taking things personally and keeping your center and your faith in yourself like concrete, regardless of outside circumstances, defining yourself from the inside out, not the outside in.
And it's hard. I'm not going to say I'm immune to disappointment. There's certain jobs, like when I read the script or I do the audition, I'm like, please let me get this. And then, you know, I try not to, because once you do an audition, you send out the ether, you got to forget it. But there are some every now and then I'm like, oh, I wonder if they're still trying to decide who to cast. I'm like, please. Just because I'm a nerd, and, you know, sometimes a job will come up and it's, you know, Star Wars related, or it's a comic book character. And I'm just like, please, 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 please. But you can't, and then you could still get fired. You could get it and get fired.
Oh, yeah.
Which happens.
So. We've all been there.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the great things about this community is that there's not, like, competition is, I can almost say it doesn't exist. I compete within myself, but everyone in this community is insanely talented and could do any and all the jobs that come through the door. Like, everybody's amazing. And I haven't experienced hostility or ickiness in our community. Like, people are genuinely awesome.
Not like in the on-camera community, for sure. I remember coming to this, when I was first doing this, I remember getting a call from a guy, another actor who I had met recently and we got along, but he was basically, you know, we were basically the same type. We would go out for the same things. I remember getting a call from him saying, hey, did you go read for this video game they're reading for over at X Studio? And I'm like, no. He's like, you should totally go and crash the audition. You'd be perfect for it. And then he hung up, and I was like, what just happened? Did my competition just call me to make sure that I was getting in on something? Like, what? This would never happen, you know, and on the backstabby, you know, on camera world that, you know, and the theater world even, you know, that I'd come from. So yeah, the community is extraordinary.
Yeah, I've had a good amount of voice actors on this show before, some really amazing people, and they all just have so much compliments for each other and for you guys. And it's really uplifting. It seems so positive. And on that, like, I talked to Sissy Jones at PAX a couple of years ago, and she mentioned, like, when I asked her for her advice for voice actors, she said, read this book that Yuri and I think you and your wife wrote together. Yeah. So I want to know, what was it that made you realize that you had kind of the experience and insights that even, like, working actors like Sissy would benefit from?
I don't know. All I know is that, you know, we had gotten to a place, Tara and I, where people kept asking us, people who wanted to get into the business, mostly younger people and, you know, the acting students and fans and who were very curious about it, would ask us sort of the same questions over and over. And we thought, wow, what would be a way that we could answer everybody's questions and not have to keep rewriting it every time? Yeah, I mean, it was almost born of laziness. No, not really.
Wrote a book out of laziness.
But we were like, what can we? And so we started compiling that into a book the response would be much easier, instead of saying, hey, well, we'll type up all, you know, all the things that we think, would be like, here's a book, you know, that would be all the things that we could tell you over coffee and more. So that was sort of how that came to be. And then we just, a year or so ago, we came out with, because we'd written that book almost 10 years ago, sort of the extended edition of that book, which has a lot more about performance capture and motion capture and the things that have really evolved over the last decade since we wrote the book.
That's cool. And I know, Jennifer, like, speaking of Sissy, you've worked with her doing some workshops. I think it's specialized workshops and actor tactics, or SWOT. Great acronym.
That organization was born of the understanding that it happened right after the strike, the game strike, the voice actor strike for games. And I wanted to connect to the devs. I thought it was just so important to go, you guys are amazing and we adore you and we love you. And I also was very aware that when you write, and I'd just done a couple of screenplay readings in people's living rooms, that when you write a movie, when you write a TV show, when you write a play, you've got friends and they all get together in your living room and they just kind of sound it out and see how it goes. And I thought, there's nothing like that for games. So we just sort of put together a core crew and we're available. We do these just like, it's a couple hours, just, it's sort of a table read just to try your stuff out. And it's sort of it's a free community service organization, if you will, to devs and it fosters connection. It also allows people to see what's possible with voice actors. Like, people don't always recognize, they think, okay, I need 10 men and you know, 8 women. And you're like, no, you need 5 guys, maybe 3 or 4, and maybe, you know, 3 or 4 women. It will cover all that for you and it'll all sound great. They don't realize what's possible. So, and also they don't always understand how amazing the stuff is once they hear it out loud. And it's just a chance for it just blossoms into growth for everything.
That's cool. I wonder if there's something that you have both taught, whether it's through the book or through those classes, that even a lot of experienced actors might overlook, that you've just learned over the years.
Is it going to matter in 5 years? Yeah. Is it going to matter in 5 years? Be kind to yourself. Mm-hmm. You, once you become a performer or a creator or anything, a human who does anything creative, and I think everything's creative, you're two people. You're the kid self that makes the creation and plays in the sandbox, and you're the grown up who adults and is the patron for the creative soul and goes out and has the job that you may love, you may not, but it makes all that possible. You are two people. This one knows about finances and budgeting and money and adulting and lifing and, you know, handling stuff. And this one just gets to play. And this one is always kind to this one. That's one thing. I started dreading auditions a while back. A good while, long while back. I hated it. I just wanted to quit. I was miserable and I couldn't figure out why until I dialed into how I was talking to myself in my head that I wasn't even aware of. I was so mean. And I went, no wonder I don't want to show up for auditions. I beat the heck out of myself. No wonder. I thought, okay, my work now is to use every audition as an opportunity to be good to myself. And that's the reason I'm going, you know, so that was very helpful for me.
Yeah, I'm still working on that. Somebody said something along the lines of when you're talking to yourself, if you wouldn't say that to somebody else, then you shouldn't be saying it to yourself either. It's not kind. And I'm still working on being okay with that or being better about that. But I definitely see what you're saying, Jen.
That's actually my I'm launching a thing called The Head Game, where it's there's so many great classes and so many great resources like your book and things like that teach people how to do this. But the trick is to bring yourself forth once you come in that room. And if you're kicking yourself the whole way, that's going to be more and more difficult. And it's just a place to put some practices and some tools in place that are like, how do you stop doing it? Let's look at that. What are the mechanics of it? Where do you screw yourself over? Here's an alternate tool. Stop sticking the fork in your eye and maybe a washcloth.
Very cool. All right. So this is the time where you guys, I know you've worked together, you're friends. I want to give you an opportunity to ask each other a question about the work you've done or approaches to acting, something that I wouldn't think of, hopefully.
I have one.
Go for it.
Yuri, what would you say to yourself 20 years ago? What would you tell yourself? If you could go back in time and tell yourself like a couple things you wish you had known then, what would you tell yourself?
You're going to be Spider-Man.
Right. if I had said that, I never would have believed it. So, and I still barely do even now. I think what I would say to myself is that you don't, and I don't mean this in a glib way, you don't have to do anything. And what I mean by that is don't try to guess what it is that they want in a performance. If you just let yourself do whatever you're going to do, sometimes it's going to be right for what they want and sometimes it's not. But it's always self-defeating to try to guess what it is they want and give them that. So just the one thing that you have that nobody else can do better than you is you. And to learn more about yourself and to be honest about who you are and not think that what you are isn't enough or it's bad or it won't work or it's not what they're looking for. It's not what that other guy did. It's not what that guy in the waiting room is clearly going to do. And that's clearly what they're looking for. You know, you just got to go in and do you and walk away. And know that is the right thing to have done. It's the sort of, that's the long-winded answer.
No, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's
good. I've spent so many years and still do occasionally, you know, stuck in that.
Yeah.
And then I remember that it's not up to me, and nothing that I can really do is going to either make or break this. I've just got to go and do the thing, you know, show up, do it, and walk away. And sometimes it'll work and sometimes it won't.
It's so funny listening to you. I can really get something that someone has told me before, which is that doing what you just described is devaluing yourself hugely.
Right.
And then it reminded me of something else, which is that all that critical voice in the head is self-abuse. Do you want to engage in self-abuse? You know? Yeah.
Right. What, how does that serve you?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that I still don't engage in it sometimes, but you know, how does it serve you? I would also like to tell I would like to sit in the row behind me when I was watching Stand By Me and go, hey, see that guy, Will Wheaton, up there? What, one day he's going to be your friend. You guys are going to play D&D together as a team. Because that would just blow my high school mind. But I have a question for Jennifer, and it's a current question. How do you, in our current situation, what do you do to get through the day, one, at, you know, alive and sane, and to stay creative and engaged? Because I'll tell you, it's been hard.
Well, I'm alive. Sane is a high mark.
Sure. Probably higher than we deserve to even shoot for these days. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually go to, there's a lot of podcasts. There's this one podcast right now that's, crazily enough, it's like a life raft. It's the Jim Fortin podcast. He's amazing. Okay. I love it. It's like a little floaty when I need one in the ocean. I slow down. I expect a lot less of myself. I mean, in that whole question, in a year, in 6 months, in 3 weeks, is this going to matter? And if it's not, what matters? What matters? And you get me all choked up now, Yuri. You did that on purpose.
What matters? Selfishly, I want to know. I want to cheat and tell, you know, cheat off your paper and do whatever it is you're doing that's working.
Is my kid fed? Did I get fed? Did I have enough water today? Is there food for the next 24 hours? Have I missed anything at work? And did I go outside? I go outside. I force myself to go outside and put my feet on the ground and literally ground myself to the earth for just, I picked him up from something yesterday, and he was, because I'm lucky enough that where we are, he gets to go do things because we're very, very clear of cases right now. And I took my shoes off and I put my feet on the ground and I just made myself sit still. And you know what? I seek silence in any pocket I can find it. Like right now, I would just, when the thoughts come up, I just go as silent as I can, just as, you know, as mindless as I can, just as la la la, because it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. And everything's okay. And look at us. We're doing so much. We're in a paradigm shift that didn't take 10 years. It took about 10 weeks. And we're expecting ourselves to function like normal. That's not nice. Mm-hmm. Would you expect it of your kid? If you'd expect it of your kid, then if you wouldn't expect it of your kid, don't expect it of yourself. You know? Mm-hmm. Be kind. Well, also, I think of the big picture. I learned a long time ago that the vibe each of us have affects the vibe of everything and the whole planet as a whole. And I just don't want to stink up the space. So I just try to go for neutral. If I can't go for happy, just go for zero. Yeah.
That's good.
Noted. Thank you.
Yeah, that's really good.
We
are running out of time. So I have to ask something that I ask everybody, and we'll get some quick responses. I want to know, if you could do anything and know that you wouldn't fail, what would you do? Yuri, you can go first.
Oh, thanks for that. I've high goals. If I could heal this divide in people today, if I could bring kindness and compassion to everyone and the ability, you know, to empathize with each other's plight and to not live in a place of fear. I know that's a tall order, but I think it'd go a long way to healing people and planet both. So
it's good. We're getting deep on this podcast.
Yeah, sorry guys. You know,
it's good.
You're thinking you can do that. You can do it right now. Just start with yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or to go to Spider-Man when you help someone. You
help yes.
That's Aunt May said that, and the game is filled with wisdom, but that is the one. But if I had one takeaway,
that's say it again.
When you help someone, you help everyone. Mm.
Jen, is there any, what would you do if you couldn't fail?
Jesus. Save the world. I would make albums all day. I'd make music all day, write songs all day.
Yeah.
I finally let myself release some of my music last month and it was, I loved it so much. And go around working with anyone who wanted to in ways to empower them to be kind to themselves and love themselves exactly where they are so then they can breathe and start going where they want to go.
Yeah. Beautiful.
And the more selfish answer would be, I just want to make like indie horror films. I just like to be on set for indie horror films and make those for, I'm approaching my Elijah Wood section of my career, I think, where that's all I want to do.
Nothing wrong with that. All right. Well, I have to say thanks for joining us, both of you guys. It's been really fascinating and insightful, and I think that people would have learned a lot about the process. And you've obviously got the experience and the leadership ability to kind of impart the essentials. So I think you've done a great job.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks to everybody out there for all the amazing work you do, and for watching and for playing and for just being here.
Yeah. Yeah,
thank you for allowing me and Jennifer to hang out for a little bit, because we haven't gotten to in a while, and selfishly that was kind of awesome.
It's funny that it takes like someone organizing like a podcast or something to catch up with people sometimes. But hey, I have to thank everybody watching at home, PAX Online. Thanks to Audio Technica. If you want to catch these guys in some games, Iron Man VR's out right now, and Jennifer is in that game as Pepper Potts, upcoming Halo Infinite whenever that comes out, and I have a feeling that Yuri will show up as Peter Parker and Miles Morales on the PS5, but hey, nothing can be confirmed. Just look at the shrugs and make up your own mind. So for more interviews like this, you can subscribe to Putting In Work on your podcast service of choice, but don't go anywhere, because PAX Online has plenty more to come. But for now, I'm John O'Peck saying take care and keep putting in work.